We're really excited to be here and thank Sean for inviting us. And it's the least she could do since she left me a year ago to go to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. So anyway, but we're really glad to be here. And we thought in the spirit of the day, we would add a couple of pictures, one at the beginning and one at the end. So we don't have anything to disclose. And these are in the abstract, so I'm not going to go through them, read them directly, but we really want to engage in a discussion, so we're going to ask you to do some things throughout this. We want to describe the important elements of qualitative study design, talk about rigor, and talk about how you can use this in public health nursing. And we hope you'll be able to understand more about some of the common methods that we use, identify elements of what a rigorous study would look like, and then be able to discuss strategies that might be helpful in addressing public health nursing issues in related to healthy communities and social justice. This is what we're going to cover today, so it kind of gives you, so as you are looking at your watch and thinking, where are they in the presentation, if you kind of remember this, this will help you. And then there's always that old adage that you should tell a joke to kind of loosen everybody up, but we're not really joke tellers. My husband knows how to tell a joke. I do not. So this was as close as we could come to a joke. So we just wanted to start with this quote from Einstein that says, not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. And then I'm going to ask my colleague to come up and go through her slides for you.
So we're just going to tag team a little bit, and an hour and a half is a long time for a presentation, so I want you to feel free to raise your hand and ask a question. It's a long time to hold questions, so feel free to engage with us if there's something that that you have a question about. How do I advance the slides?
No, that's forward, that's back.
Okay, all right, cool. Okay, so I just want to get a feel for my audience. How many of you have done qualitative research? Okay, great. Then we're gonna have a good time. How many of you have had funded qualitative research? Ah, there's the difference, okay? That many of us have grounding, have coursework, have an interest in doing qualitative research and doing research that captures the context and the complexities of the individuals that we serve. Barbara and I love doing qualitative research. It's become our life. But getting funded and establishing the rigor of qualitative research is the significant challenge now. Those of you who, since most of you have some experience with qualitative research, you know that it's holistic, that we focus on the experience of the people that we're concerned about. We want to make sure that we get their stories, their context, and their environment well documented. I like to think about quantitative versus qualitative research in this way. Quantitative research is a really good way of shining a spotlight on a very focused question. In my quantitative training, people are always like, well, you've got to narrow and narrow and narrow your question. Sometimes what I want to do is just turn on the floodlights and look at everything. Look at the context. Look at the environment. Look at the relationships. Shine a big shining light on the phenomena that I'm trying to study. And then I may decide at some point, or my quantitative colleagues may decide at some point, to use what I'm doing and shine that spotlight. Common assumptions in qualitative research. Reality is socially constructed. When I present my students with that construct, I get a lot of blank looks sometimes, depending upon where they're coming from. that what is important is not some kind of absolute truth, but the way people perceive that truth and the way they create their own worlds of meaning. And so qualitative research allows us to kind of look at those aspects with some relativity and different interpretations, different worldviews, different contexts, different cultures, and to allow for those kinds of variations. Where in quantitative research, sometimes we're just so focused and we have to be so careful in our operational definitions that we lose this holistic context. Characteristics of qualitative research, number one, it's naturalistic. That is, we don't do anything in a lab. I know at our college, when they talk about research, they say, well, you know, how are you going to set up your lab? And I'm like, well, my lab is the community. My lab is the people out in the community. I need a desk. I need a computer. I need a space for a student to sit. That's really all I need. Because I'm going out in the field. I'm not staying in a lab. Phenomenological, we're looking at the experience of the individual. We're looking at what happens to people in our healthcare context or healthcare environments. Dr. Lutz and I have been working on her stroke study, where we're looking at the experience of people transitioning from rehab to home after stroke. And you know, what's important to us is to be in rehab with those individuals, looking at the whole experience, what they're experiencing, and to try to then tease out what the meaning of that experience is. And that's what we mean by that hermeneutic aspect. There are things that you get when you do qualitative research. You can get an ethnography, which is a description of a phenomenon, looking at the cultural context particularly. And we think of ethnographies as kind of the Margaret Mead anthropology kinds of things, but ethnographies are very rich in tradition and healthcare. You may get a typology or a list of things that you want to know about. One study that I worked on where we developed a typology, we were looking at abuse of women with disabilities, and we wanted to know who the perpetrators were. So we took the narratives from the women and started to make a list of every potential perpetrator for that sexual abuse. We also use our qualitative information to help with instrument development or survey design so that you provide a good foundation and context. I was working on a study of sexuality of women with disabilities, and we did 31 interviews, and then we used the words of the women themselves to construct our questions on our survey so that it was rang true and was relevant for the women that we were sending the survey to. You can also use qualitative research for program planning and evaluation. So developing action plans, making a difference, making changes in policy, those kinds of things may be the purpose and the outcome that you want from qualitative research. And finally, there's theory building, or not finally, but theory building is another way. How many of you have done grounded theory research? I mean, it's one of the major methods and methodologies and approaches in qualitative research. What it allows us to do is to build theory, to create theory. Quantitative research is particularly effective at testing theory, but not so great at building theory. And our qualitative research, the outcome may be that you're designing a model, you're designing a theory, you're designing an explanation for the phenomenon that you are trying to find out about.
So next, we wanted to talk a little bit about what some of the common methodologies are, and we're not going to go into any specific detail about each of these. We just want to familiarize you with those. That was a long word for me. Anyway, so that you can be thinking about how they differ. So the first one that we commonly see in public health would be ethnography. And ethnography's roots are based in anthropology. An ethnography typically describes a cultural or social group or social system. So you can have an ethnography that focuses on a particular ethnic culture or a particular region of the country, but ethnographies can also focus on groups who share common experiences. Like you might have a medical ethnography of a public health department or of a rural region or of a unit on a hospital even, or that kind of thing. And ethnography is typically an in-depth description about this particular culture or cultural group or social group. And so we use lots of different kinds of methods of data collection when we're doing ethnography. We'll go out in the field and observe. We might look at a map. One of my colleagues did an ethnography related to sexually transmitted illness in adolescent men. And so the first thing they did, they were doing four counties in Florida, was they got a map of each of the counties and they marked where people lived and then where the clinics were that people could get access to care, because this was for Latino men was what the group they were looking at. And then they talked to key stakeholders, not just the adolescent young men that had the diseases or were sexually active, but also people who provided services, people in the schools. So it was we cast our net and try to far and wide to try to get the people that we need to talk to. So you have prolonged observation. You're both participating and stepping back, and you might sit in on health department meetings in that study, or council meetings, or go to a school football game and watch behaviors there, and take data that way, as well as talking to people. So the kinds of questions that might that you might be able to answer are related to really getting a good description of a particular culture or social group. If we don't have a good understanding of the group, it's difficult then to design interventions to help them, because we really need to understand them from their perspective. The next one's grounded theory. This is primarily what I do in my work. Its disciplinary roots are in sociology. It focuses more on processes and interactions between people within groups and across different groups. So one example that's coming out of our study is looking at caregiver and patient communication with providers in rehab, and what are the caregivers in particular, what's their view of how the providers communicate with them, and we are actually developing some typologies related to that, and what that process, how that influences what people's experiences as they transition home from rehab, and what they know and are able to do when they get home in terms of the care for the patient. The theory is developed from the ground up. That's why it's called grounded theory. You start with the participants' views and you build theory. So you start with very concrete data that you've collected through interviews and observations, and as you begin to analyze it, you build levels of abstraction and develop conceptual models or theories from that. Context in all of these methods is extremely important. So the kinds of questions that work really well for grounded theory are things about that reflect process. So things about decision making. I had a student who just published an article on how caregivers of people with Parkinson's disease make decisions related to institutionalization. This is really important right now with the new focus on patient-centered outcomes and including patients and families in decisions about their care and understanding better how people learn to self-manage and the priorities people set when they try to self-manage a chronic disease. And it helps us really understand how people make choices that might be different than the choices we as healthcare providers would expect them to make based on our background. So it's been a really useful method for me in my work. Community-based participatory research, we include in this as a qualitative methodology. Generally, you use qualitative and quantitative when you do CBPR, but most of this starts with a qualitative piece, either doing focus groups with a community advisory board. But the whole goal of CBPR is really a partnership, building a partnership with the group that you want to work with, and having them help guide the problems that you study, how you study them, the people that you talk to, and then bringing what you find with them back to the community to help decide what kinds of solutions then, once you've identified problems, how would you implement solutions. It's really, it comes out of a more of a critical social theorist underpinnings, but it really is I suppose, third or fourth generation of the old participatory action research and community development research that we used to do in the 60s. And it fits really well, obviously, with public health, because that's, as public health nurses, how we're trained to really include our communities in our work and partner with them. I'm not sure we always do as good a job with that as we should, but that's really the goal. So really, with questions related to this would be looking at a particular community group and working with them to solve a problem. When I worked with Dr. Knipe on her study, it was working with women on welfare and looking at what kinds of public health nursing interventions might we be able to do that would help them have better success as they went through the welfare to work program, and how did they define health, and how did they meet their health care needs, and what could we do to help them with those needs. There are lots of others. Photo Voice is another one that you'll see a lot of. A lot of other interesting methodologies that we can use, but the commonality of all of them is there's a real focus on the participant's voice and checking in with the participants as you go along to make sure that your interpretations are rendering their stories and their experiences the way that they have defined them, so that you're not going out and just talking to them and coming back as a researcher and saying, this is what we think they're talking about. This is an example of here are things where people are in denial or coping, which are kind of nursing terms. We take what we find back to those participants and say, here's what we're hearing. How does this fit with what you told us? Or to a new group of similar participants, like if we've interviewed caregivers, then to take the data. A nice story of this with our work is we've done this work with stroke caregivers, and I was invited up to Pennsylvania to speak at a conference there and meet with a support group of stroke caregivers. And I was telling them what we were hearing from the caregivers in Florida, and they said, you get the experience. You understand what it is. Other people haven't understood this, but what you're describing is what we're experiencing. So it helps to validate, and we'll talk a little more about that later. So how do you design, this is probably why you're all here, right? How do you design a fundable proposal using qualitative methods? I started my PhD program in 1995, and with the exception of 2 years, I was funded on a stipend my first year, but then I got funding from NINR, I got an NRSA, and then I had 1 year at Florida that I was not funded. But I have had funding, continuous funding. I've not had huge funding. I've not had an R01 yet. But we're still building this work on stroke caregiving towards an intervention. We're not there yet, but we're getting closer. I've had small funding. I've had funding from the VA, and I've had R15 funding, which is typically about a $250,000 to $300,000 grant. But it's funding, and my college likes that. So I have been able to do that. But a lot of that is really good writing and carrying the threads of what you want to do through your proposal. So we're going to talk about that. So the typical sections of a proposal, and these are the NIH ones, but more and more even with small grants, you're beginning to see these sections. You have that they call it page one, or that first page on an NIH proposal that includes a description, and then at the end you have your study purpose and your aims and or research questions. Sometimes you'll have aims and research questions. In some of our studies we've just had aims. But there's always a study purpose that kind of encompasses the larger purpose of the study. Then you go into the background and significance, innovation, then you get more detailed in your research design, methodology and methods, and I'll talk about those. But essentially, the way I distinguish methodology from methods is methodology is grounded theory. I'm going to use grounded theory, and here are the conceptual or theoretical underpinnings of grounded theory to let the reviewer know that I get what grounded theory is and I know how to do it. I know what it means to say I'm doing grounded theory. And then the methods are the tools that you use, and the tools have to be consistent with the methodology. That's really key. So this first page, this is the gotcha page. And if you don't grab the reviewer in that first page, then it's an uphill battle the rest of the way. You have to get them that first page. So you have to provide compelling evidence for why you need to do this study now, and why you're the most, why you can do this, and why the way you want to do it is the right way to do it. So you want to provide compelling evidence, you want a purpose statement, and that purpose statement should be the same purpose statement on that page as it is when you state it in the methodology section or if you state it anywhere else. Don't rewrite the purpose statement. You know, keep it, take the same sentence and say the purpose of this study is to XYZ, and then cut it and paste it. You want that thread. These threads are really critical. Make sure that you're linking to the funding agency's goals or aims. If you're out and if you think your thing is kind of on the hairy edge of linking to their aims, you need to figure out a way to make it link. One of my colleagues, and she didn't do qualitative research, but Audrey Nelson, who was really interested in back injuries in nurses, was able to get a lot of money related to patient safety by reframing what she wanted to do to link it to patient safety. So think about your questions and how can you frame them to link to whatever the funding agency, there's got to be a connection. Make sure your aims and research questions are driving the study design. If you have a quantitative question, you should be doing a quantitative study. And if you have a qualitative question, don't try to turn it into a more quantitative question. So you can use a quantitative study design because that's what you like. That's really important. You need to provide a really, really good rationale for using a qualitative design. Hit the gaps briefly, this is on that one page, so you've got to be succinct, and why is your design appropriate? I'm just going to show you in the orange, you can see some of the wording that we used to try to make this compelling. So we talk about the deleterious effects of caregiving. It's a major public health concern, and we had a citation for that. Caregivers are adversely affected. Research has failed to address the crisis-driven approach. It's very powerful language, and it's a hook. Now, I will say, I think part of the reason our work gets funded is because most of the reviewers are older, like 40s, because they're more senior people, right? And many of them are experiencing this problem about aging parents or being, you know, having, or an aging spouse, and they know it's a problem. If you've gone through it, you're probably more likely to be sympathetic to wanting, if there haven't been good solutions for you. So I have to say, I think we are studying something that's important right now in this society, and people recognize that. And I think that has helped us with our funding. We've identified this idea that you have to match the patient to the caregiver, and that we need to understand that because nobody talks about that. And then we talk about how we address NINR's areas of emphasis. And then these are the aims. So our goal is to develop a conceptual framework that illustrates this match that we've just talked about in the previous paragraph, and here are our research questions. Really specific about what we're going to do. So then you move on. I'll talk a little more about research questions and purpose statements, which you talk about in your first page, and then you include them again in your methodology when you're going to describe what you're going to do. They're not hypotheses. They're usually how or what questions. They tend to be broader and exploratory in nature. And again, I'm highlighting this. I'm going to highlight this throughout. Design is dependent on your questions. And so you really need to know what you want to know. In this case, if you're thinking about the influence of culture or social groups, ethnography is probably more, might be more appropriate. If you really want to understand a process, choices, decision-making, sort of how things happen over time, even if you want to bring culture into it, grounded theory is a good method for that. Phenomenology, which we didn't talk about, is more about the meaning of an experience. And I think phenomenological studies are probably harder to get funded. I've not ever written one, but my sense is they're harder because it's more, internal to the person, and people have a little harder time understanding sort of how that's going to be useful in intervention design and that kind of thing. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I would say that I think they're more difficult to get funded. And then CBPR, if you're going to partner with a community. And you can combine these. You can do a CBPR-focused study with a small grounded theory piece in it, or a small ethnography, or an ethnographic piece in it. So it's not that you just do one of these things. You might, but not necessarily. Okay, so you want to go ahead and do this piece?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to make you work now. Sorry. This is supposed to be interactive. So what I want you to do is to think about your field, what you're interested in, and, you know, when you're writing your proposal, your question is so important. And spending time writing your question, refining your question, discussing your question with your colleagues, really, really important. So I want you to just take a couple of minutes and write three questions that are of interest to you in your area, but questions that you can't answer quantitatively. Things that, what we've talked about in qualitative design, would be the preferred methodology. All right. So just write three questions, and then we're going to ask you to do some things with that. So just write your three questions. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. There. We have more examples later, but so
you can see the what and the how questions there. Thank you. You got your questions, so you need a little more time. Everybody? Ready? Okay. All right. So now that you've got some ideas of questions that are relevant to you, what we'd like you to do is kind of reflect on those questions and think about, what are the assumptions underneath your questions? Are you assuming a particular reality? Remember, reality is socially constructed. Are you trying to define your terms, or are you leaving your questions open to your participants, your informants, really helping you define what your definitions are? Are you pulling from the literature in terms of how you're asking your questions and how you're wording your questions? And also, can you reflect on how those questions are coming from your experience and your perspective? Because that's really important in qualitative research. We call that reflexivity, and we'll talk about that a little later. That you're coming at your question from your experience and your perspective, or the perspective of the literature, or the perspective of the people that you've worked with. So just kind of hold those thoughts and answer those questions for yourself. So these are examples of questions that we asked on some studies. What are the experiences of stroke patients and their caregivers as they're discharged from the hospital? Another example, what is the impact of diabetes on older Latino adults who live independently in the community? Or what are the health-related needs of migrant workers in North Central Florida, and how can we address them? So those are just some other examples of questions. So now what I'd like you to do is to get in pairs and just share your questions with each other, with one other person, just to kind of get an idea of how you're thinking about your questions. Thank you.
So one more minute and then we'll come back together. If you'll just kind of come back to attention in the group. And so we don't have time to have everybody talk about your questions, but I'd like just a couple of examples of questions that you've come up with, that you've kind of vetted with your colleagues, and you might be interested in sharing with the group. Anybody? Yeah. Fantastic question. Fantastic question.
Repeat it so that, because it'll be taped.
Okay. How do African American teenage girls negotiate condom use with their intimate partners? Did I get that right? Okay. So tremendous elements of this question. You can't possibly think of a way to quantify this. You have to look at that interpersonal communication. You've got the cultural aspects. You have the teenage culture. So great question. Great question. Okay, thanks for sharing. Anybody else? There was another hand over here. Yes. Okay, so what role do public health nurses have in infant feeding in African-American mothers? Okay, great. Again, so you notice that these questions are open-ended. These are not yes or no questions. These are not counting questions. These are questions that talk about context and culture and meaning. And that's what qualitative research is designed to do.
So now we're going to talk about some of the next sections of the proposal. So now you've got an idea about what you want to do. And I will tell you that they always tell you write your first page and get that done and then build your proposal around that. I do that, but then I change my first page.
And
you'll see at the end of this we have some sort of bullet points sort of take homes, but one of the things is whether you're a linear writer or a nonlinear writer, and I think most of us that do qualitative research are nonlinear writers because our thoughts develop as we're writing, and that's probably true of people who are doing quantitative, but it's really true in the qualitative because as you're writing this proposal, you're finding things in the literature and it's raising new questions and you're going back and revising your aims and your questions. So just because you've written it doesn't mean it's going to be the be-all, end-all question. So keep that in mind as you go forward. So you really want to do a brief, focused history of what's been done about the problem. What do we know about this? What do we know about African-American teens negotiating condom use or the public health nursing role? What do we know about the problem that you're studying? What does the literature say about it? And what are the gaps? And how will your study address these gaps? And why is this study important to do at this moment in time? Why is it critical that this is the next study? Now, a lot of times in qualitative research, we have to be careful about how much of the literature that we don't want to let the literature define our definitions when we're interviewing, collecting our data, and and carrying out the study. But you have to make a case if you're going to get funded. So you write this background and significance section, keeping in mind that some of the things you learn, you're going to try to set aside as much as you can, or at least use them as comparative with your data, as a way to compare your data to what you're learning. So that's really important. But you do have to have that. This is one of the things we've used. Actually, this is thanks to Dr. Knipe. At the end of our background and significance section, we will often do a table that summarizes the gaps and needs for future research that makes the case for our question or our study at this point in time. It saves the reviewers a ton of time. They don't have to slog through. They can if they want, but your lit review. They can look at this and really see what, you know, what's going on in the literature at this time. This is from a study, I think it's from the first R15, I can't remember. Anyway, but it gives you a sense of what the gaps were in that literature at that time when we submitted this grant. again, as any study, your lit review depends on the questions being asked. And you often will go back to the literature after you begin the study because you'll begin identifying concepts that you never thought of when you were doing your first literature review. Obviously, if you didn't think of them, you're not going to include them in your proposal. But as you're becoming more abstract in your analysis, you may pick up on concepts that you hadn't thought of, and you may go to new and different literature. One of the examples that we had in our research team when I was in school was someone was interested in mentoring of, I think it was case managers in a health department or in a community-based agency. And so they ended up going to the apprenticeship literature because what they were identifying in the interviews was it was kind of an apprenticeship approach that some of these mentors were using. So they looked at literature specifically on apprenticeship. When they wrote a proposal, they probably wouldn't have pulled that concept in. So it is this back and forth, and you need to be open to that. Be mindful of and discuss the assumptions you're bringing. We'll talk a little more about reflexivity, but one of the things we have our students do, and we try to do, is really talk in our research team about what is it that we're bringing to this and what is it that we're finding either in the literature, in our data, as we're doing, as we're collecting it. So one of the things we want you to do now, and I'm not going to give you very long because we don't want to get too far behind on this, but look at the questions or as I go along and think about what search terms you might use to answer, you know, to look at the literature for the questions that you've written. So I'll go ahead, but be thinking about that because that's really important as you go forward. Let's talk a little about innovation. This is really big in NIH right now. It used to be, I don't know that they talked as much specifically about this term, but what they want to know is the project original and innovative? So does it challenge existing paradigms or clinical practice? Does it address an innovative research question or critical barrier to progress in the field? And does it develop or employ novel concepts, approaches, methodologies, tools, or technologies for this area? You have to address this if you want funding from NIH, and you have to make a really strong statement about this. One of the things that we're looking at now with our work is in moving forward is we've got a couple things. I'm trying to think one that's more qualitative. One of them is how do you design a patient-centered intervention and maintain fidelity, intervention fidelity. If you're going to have an intervention that you give the same to every person, how can it be patient-centered? So we're actually going to be developing a proposal around that to look at new ways to design interventions. And that will be a qualitative study where we talk to patients about how would this particular intervention we want to do look patients, what would be important to you to have in it, and then think about how we can make that patient-centered. So a lot of the qualitative stuff with the new focus on patient-centered care and individualized care, I'm hoping we'll see more, you know, more studies getting funded around some of these questions. I talked a little about this earlier, but your methodology precedes your methods. It summarizes your overall approach in more detail. Now you're going to explain why you chose this approach over others. How are you conceptualizing your research design? Make sure you include a theoretical or conceptual framework, even if this is qualitative. Now, it might be as simple as saying, in grounded theory, I do grounded theory from a symbolic interactionism perspective using a social constructivist approach. And I say that in my methodology. Now, I may not have a theoretical model at that point if it's a brand new question. Now, because of the work we've done, I've got some theoretical models based on the data that we've collected. So we have a theoretical model we've developed related to stroke and this transition from rehab to home, because that's really what we're looking at. And we've identified that as a real crisis point for people. And we've identified characteristics of what that crisis is for those caregivers. So what I might do if I wanted to go into another caregiver population is say, here's the model we developed for stroke. How might this fit with caregivers of adolescents who were in a motor vehicle accident? We expect there will be differences, but maybe some of the concepts, we expect some of the concepts will be the same. So I'm building on that theory that we're already developing. But if you don't have that, if it's a brand new study and nobody's really done anything in your area, then you talk more about what are the theoretical or conceptual underpinnings of the approach that you're using. You can't just duck the question. Well, it's qualitative, we don't have to have that. Okay, next. That doesn't work for reviewers. They don't like that because they think you didn't know enough to address it. Make sure you include relevant references. If you tell me you're going to do grounded theory, I better see some really seminal grounded theory references in your list. Glaser and Strauss, Sharmaz, because if I'm doing constructivist grounded theory, if you're doing ethnography, you want to see maybe Wolcott or some of the other ethnographers. I don't know who's the one in CBPR, Minkler. So you want to see those seminal references if you're a reviewer. So the data that you're going to collect is going to be typically descriptive, narrative, and observational, and it's going to focus on human experiences and perceptions. And there's a high level of researcher involvement. You'll see in a lot of the texts that they say the researcher is the instrument. When you do a quantitative study, you give somebody a survey, or you might do a phone survey, but you still have the instrument is that survey. In qualitative, you, as the interviewer, are the instrument. You're shaping the direction that interview goes based on what the person is telling you and based on the guide that you've developed. So you got to be clear that you recognize that and think about how you're going to minimize your preconceived ideas about this topic as you're doing the interviews and address that in the proposal. Talk about that, and we'll get to that a little bit later. You want to record your data. People do video and photographic data. We currently do audio recording. We audio record all of our interviews and transcribe them verbatim. And we use a professional transcription company, and I highly recommend it because if you find somebody who's really good, it's much easier to do your verification because you have to verify that data. So you have to say that in the proposal. We're going to get a professional transcriptionist to do this, and we're going to verify the accuracy of the transcripts by listening to the recording and checking the transcript. So those are really, really key. There are lots of sampling strategies that you can use. Typically what you'll see is something called purposeful or purposive, S-I-V-E, sampling. Either one is okay. Any of these are very typical that you'll see. I didn't include theoretical. If you're doing grounded theory, you better talk about theoretical sampling, and you better give me an example of what you mean by that. We're going to use theoretical sampling. For example, if we find this, then we're going to do this. We're going to sample this group. Or in the previous study, when we found this, then we sampled this way. Because as a reviewer, then I know you know what that means. Don't just throw words out that are jargon without demonstrating that you know what they mean. Another one we see a lot of is saturation, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Decisions about sampling and sampling strategies depend on the goals of the study and your research questions. You can have samples that are individuals. You can have a group or an organization or a community. You can sample by particular characteristics, although, again, you have to be really careful that those that you make, you provide a rationale for why you're selecting all women, all men, a particular ethnic group, older, younger. Why did you pick that? How does that fit with what you're doing? And our sample sizes are generally small, and that's okay because we're gonna sample till we reach saturation. But then you have to tell me as a reviewer what that means. And essentially what that means is that you are hearing the same stories and there are no new themes or concepts that you're identifying in the data. And it often happens pretty quickly, but you have to provide a rationale for that. Okay.
So when you're talking about data collection, it's very important that you provide a description of the sources of your data, and so that your reviewers will know what it is you're going to be working with, right? And there are lots of potential sources of data in qualitative research. One source of data is something that is already existing. Right. So it may be written materials. It may be program materials, records that are already in existence. It may be correspondence or a publication or a diary or a report or even photographs or artistic works, memorabilia that people have. There are lots of things that may already be in existence to answer your question, help answer your question. So if you're working with existing data, you've got to be very clear with your reviewers what that data is, where it resides, how you're going to access it, and what you're going to do with it. We also do observational data, and this is a foundation in ethnography that you go in and you immerse yourself in the culture, and your data becomes your report of what you see and what you hear and what you experience. So it's very important that if you're going to be doing observational data, that you spend a lot of time with the population that you're working with, that you develop the relationships that you need with the participants. And I'm thinking of the teen mothers. If you're going to be asking them, or I'm confusing your two questions. If you're going to be asking questions about intimate sexual behavior, you need to be connected with that community. You need to have an in with that community. You need to have a relationship with the individuals that you're going to be asking your questions of. So it may be that you want to do some observations, that you want to spend some time in what we call the field and get to know what's going on. So it's not that you're just coming in as an outsider and asking questions, so that you begin to be an insider, and so your participants begin to trust you. You have different types of roles when you're doing observation. You can have a participant role. You can have a non-participant role. So if you were doing adolescent teenagers and you're not an adolescent teenager, you're going to be a non-participant. But if you're looking at public health nurses, and you can be a participant. So you are in there with them, asking the questions and experiencing what the phenomena that you're trying to do. And you bring that experience to your research questions and to your data collection. Most of the time, we do overt observations, that is, that the people that we're observing know we're observing. But sometimes we have a compelling question and a risk benefit that our IRB will approve, where we would do some covert observations, the people that you're observing are not necessarily aware that you're observing them. But you've got to have some really good rationale for doing that. Duration in the field is so critical. This qualitative research is not quick and dirty. That's what I tell my students. You know, if you want to do a dissertation in a year and get graduated, don't do qualitative, you know, because you're going to need to spend time in the field. You're going to need to spend time with your participants, and you're going to end up with tons and tons of data, and your analysis takes a lot longer, and your writing takes a lot longer. But that time in the field, that connection with your participants, the expansiveness of knowledge that you get, even though we're working with small numbers, and just thinking about the strike study, across Dr. Lutz's study, we probably have, 40 dyads now across two studies, so that's 80 people. So, you know, we're getting a pretty good chunk of people interactions there, and we've spent a long time in our data site. We're going into a rehab hospital. They know us. We sit in on team meetings. We can walk into therapy rooms. We walk into patient rooms. We're not outsiders anymore, and that's what you want to do.
But it took us a long time to get there.
A long time.
A long time.
Right.
4 years.
Right. Right. 4 years, before, or a couple of years at least, before they're like, who are you and why are you here again? when you do your observations, you need to do field notes. All right. So this is what you're going to describe in your proposal. It's how you're going to write up your observations and what you're going to do with your field notes. When you're doing field notes, you want to write them every day you're in the field. They need to be very specific, detailed, rich. You need to have your reader engaged. If somebody is reading your field notes, it's going to be like they're going to be there. So you need to practice that writing. You also include in your field notes your own reactions and hypotheses and interpretations of the data. This is separate from your concrete descriptive field notes, but you keep your memos, you keep your ideas. You don't ever let an idea go. And so what you need to do when you're writing your proposal is describe this process in some detail, what you're going to observe, how long you're going to spend in the field, and how you're going to document your observations. Second type of potential data collection, regardless of your methodology, is using qualitative interviews. Interviews allow you to enter another person's perspective, to get their feelings, thoughts, intentions. What's important about interviewing is the skill of the interviewer, right? So if you're going to be doing the interviews, you need to make sure that your interviewing skills are up to snuff. If you're going to have research assistants doing the interviews, then you need to train those individuals. And you need to be very specific in your proposal about how you're going to train and supervise your interviewers so that you're getting good and rich data. And oftentimes you're combining your interviews with your observational data. Just in the interest of time, I'm not going to spend too much more time on interviewing, but I think that it's important that you focus on, for your proposal, the development of your interview guide, right? Your reviewers will want an interview guide. I'm the kind of person that says, I'm going to sit down and have a open-ended conversational interview with somebody that's experiencing stroke recovery, and that's all you need to know. No, your reviewers are going to want more. They're going to want a guide. Your IRB is going to want a guide. The guide includes the topics to be covered, open-ended, broad questions that can't be answered with a yes or no. if your guide is conversational, then you need to have language in there that says, this is just a guide. I may change the wording of the questions. I may use the language of my participants when I'm talking about sexual activity, and not follow these words precisely, right? So you do this in your proposal. You need to include your interview guide with your proposal. Except maybe in CBPR, where you can say that your interview guide is going to be developed along with your participants as part of that process. But even then, your reviewer is going to want to see what those questions are that you're going to use. Here's an interview guide example from the stroke study. Tell me about your stroke or your loved one's stroke. Tell me about the stay on the rehab unit. How has your experience been so far? So you see that these are broad, general, open-ended, not yes or no questions, not closed questions. And we allow ourselves to follow a thread. So if somebody brings something new to us, we want to be flexible enough to go with that thread in the interview and follow that, because that may be a very important piece of new information. I'm going to skip a few. So just take a couple of minutes, 2 minutes, and take your interview question or your research question and write one or two interview questions that you would use. So, and just go ahead and share them with your partner that you partnered with originally, just for about a minute. Okay, I'm going to ask you to kind of hold those thoughts. Just kind of moving on, remember that the interviewer is your research instrument. So it's so important that your interviewing skills, your rapport building skills are present. Otherwise, you're not going to get good data. I want to talk just a few minutes about focus groups because, as Dr. Knipp wanted us to be very, very clear, focus group is not a methodology. Focus group is a tool, right? People tend to think that focus groups are an easy way to do data collection. I will tell you from my work that working with focus group data is so complex, and it's so hard, and it's so difficult to analyze that you really need to have a compelling reason why you want to do a focus group and not necessarily have that be your first method. But you can get good data from focus groups. What I recommend if you're doing focus groups is that you always have at least two people leading the focus group, one person to be the facilitator and another person to be a recorder. So you can keep track of what's going on, both the verbal and the nonverbal things that are happening in focus groups. you want to make sure that you do both an audio tape, and sometimes you would have multiple tape recorders, or a video recorder. If you've ever tried to do a transcript of a focus group, you know that identifying who is speaking is oftentimes a great challenge if you don't have a video or you weren't there and you can't remember who the people are. People tend to talk over one another. People tend to either be domineering and talk too much, or to be too quiet. So you need to make sure as the focus group leader that you get everyone has the opportunity to speak, and then when you do your transcripts that you are able to separate who is speaking and what's being said. Another technique in focus group is to ask, as you've gotten the recorder person, to kind of conceptualize the ideas, to then give that back to the participants, say, this is what I've heard. Let's make a list of all the points that have been discussed here and make sure that we have everybody represented and we've got everything on this list. Focus group logistics are sometimes very, very complicated. Transportation, location, just getting the participants to a location. I know I've done focus groups with women with disabilities. It's a lot easier for me to go to someone's home and do an interview than it is to get half a dozen women with disabilities to come to a location with the transportation and the mobility issues that they might have. When we're doing focus groups, 8 to 12 participants, you usually want to have more people scheduled because some people will just back out and they won't come at the last minute. The advantages of focus groups, though, it's an excellent way to tap into the expertise of a population, and it's a really good community engagement strategy in CBPR. But you've got to screen your participants, make sure that they're comfortable and that they're going to be willing to discuss the more difficult issues, that, say, again, using the example of condom use. You know, if you're going to do a focus group, are your participants going to be willing to talk about condom use and intimate activity and that kind of thing around other people? I've already gone through some of the disadvantages. Another one of the disadvantages of doing focus groups, something you have to pay attention to, is what's going on, what are the kind of underlying dynamics of the group. So if you've got some real good group dynamic skills, maybe you will see that the participants aren't really trusting the facilitator, the participants aren't really trusting each other, and pay attention to those dynamics, because that may definitely impact the way you have to interpret your data.
So when you talk about qualitative data analysis, this is another big area where I find problems when I review grants, is that people will say, we're going to do thematic analysis of our data or identify themes in our data. Okay, what does that mean? What do you mean by that? So you want to talk about things like data analysis begins as you're collecting the data. This is an iterative process. When you collect data, you're thinking about what people are telling you. You're even changing your questions or asking probes based on what you're hearing. Then you get back and you should be looking at that data immediately to see what kinds of things people are telling you, to make sure that your questions and your guide capture what they need to capture, or that you can revise your guide as you go along depending on what you're learning. You want rich, thick descriptions. So you want to talk about what that means. And when you're doing analysis, you want to talk about how you're going to organize it. You're going to maybe read through it to get a sense of the whole. You're going to code for recurring themes and categories. And then you're going to take it to a group. You shouldn't do this in isolation. You should always have a group. Typically, in what we do, we have an interdisciplinary group. We don't just use nurses. Mary Ellen is not a nurse, as a matter of fact, because it's really important. Nurses bring a particular perspective to the data they're reading. And they identify themes that a rehab counselor or a social worker or a teacher might not identify. And so they will hold your feet to the fire and say, show me where that is in the data. So when you're writing a proposal, you want to say, you know, we have people with expertise in this, and it's multidisciplinary. You want to talk about your audit trail, how you're going to track decisions that you make through this process. We talk about memoing and grounded theory. So field notes are what you write when you're doing an interview or an observation. Memoing is what you're writing when you're doing your analysis. And that's really important as well, because the reviewer wants to know that you how you're going to get from, you know, point A to B to C to D, because what you end up with may look very different from where you started in terms of when you're doing the project. When you do data, you'll typically talk about coding, finding patterns or themes. We use a process called dimensional analysis. You really need to, when in grounded theory, we also talk about constant comparative analysis. And again, you better be citing those folks that have written about those kinds of analytic strategies. In ethnography, you're more likely to talk about thematic analysis. But you're looking for emergent patterns in the data. One of the things we use, and this was actually developed after as a way to evaluate qualitative studies, but one of the things I talk to my students about, or when we're writing a proposal, is to think about what is it that we really want to get from this qualitative data? Do we really want a conceptual rendering or an interpretive explanation, or is a thematic survey more what we're looking for? It depends on what the purpose of the study is. And so if you think about that on this continuum, it'll help you think about how to write about what you're going to do with your data. There's a lot of software available to do data, to help you manage the data. It does not do the analysis for you. A lot of times people think, oh, there's this great software, we just put the data in and it'll help us analyze. It will help you manage it, and you get volumes of data, really, and it can do some great stuff, but you really need to know what you're doing. Most proposals want to see that you're going to use some kind of data management software, though. Okay, you want to talk about this and then go on to evaluating?
I've already talked about some of the challenges of focus group data analysis and debriefing participants. I've already done that.
Okay.
All right, good. So now I'm going to talk about rigor in qualitative research. Right? So when you're writing a proposal and you're presenting your research, people tend to think of qualitative research as non-rigorous, slippery,
soft,
subjective, a lot of S words,
yeah.
Things that make qualitative research sound less scientific and less rigorous. And if you've been working with qualitative research for a while, you begin to know that there is definite rigor, there are definite criteria for good qualitative studies and for weak qualitative studies. And so in a proposal, you want to address the rigor of your study. And if you were doing a quantitative proposal, you would be talking about validity and reliability. When you're talking about qualitative studies, you talk about credibility and trustworthiness, dependability of your data, transferability, and applicability. And this is, we left the reference off of this. This is from Miles and Huberman, which is a really good resource in terms of helping you do your data analysis and establish rigor. So I'm just going to go through these really quickly. What's in parentheses is the criteria that you would use in a quantitative study, and what's at the top is the what you talk about in a qualitative study. So we don't talk about internal validity, but we talk about credibility and authenticity. And this is, you know, this is where the truth of your study comes in. This is where your rich description, the data, the words of your participants allows the reader and reviewer to know that you are capturing that experience in great detail and in great richness. You need to be linking your description to your theoretical categories if you're doing grounded theory. You also need to make sure that when you don't find something, that you talk about it, right? That you're looking for the negative cases, that you're looking for alternative explanations. We just had a student present some data, and she had thought that she would find something in her data that just was not there. And so she came to the data analysis group and said, what do I do? And the answer was, that's your finding, that what you were expecting as a nurse, and this was in intraventricular hemorrhage and neonates, and the moms weren't talking about IVH. And so it's like, that's your finding, that the moms don't conceptualize this medical condition. They've got what they're talking to you about is the whole experience. You also want to be able to go back to your participants and say, this is what we found, this is what we want to share with you, and ask if there's something else that you need to add or that we need to do. Confirmability or trustworthiness is another criteria. This is the objectivity that you would have in quantitative research. You need to describe your methods. You need to describe your approach very systematically. You need an audit trail. I always ask my students, where's your audit trail? Your audit trail tells me every day that you worked on your study, what is it that you did? And what did you think about it, right? And making sure that what you're thinking goes along with how you're interpreting your data. So your biases, if you're approaching your data from a certain perspective, you want to make sure that that is clear, right? So that subjectivity, it's yes, we have subjectivity in there, but we make our subjectivity explicit to our readers and to our reviewers. Dependability, auditability are the words that we use when we're talking about reliability as a quantitative concept. So are your questions clear? Is the role of the researcher clearly described? Have you brought in a good description of the paradigms that you're using or the theoretical constructs that you're doing? Is your data collection complete? Did you do what you said you needed to do? Have you done your coding checks? Have you managed the quality of your data? And have you done that peer review? That peer review, that peer debriefing is so important. So you've got a group of people that look at your data with you and say, yes, you're on the right track. Right, that's how we establish the reliability. Everybody always wants to know, are your results generalizable? Do you have external validity? That kind of thing. You need to address those questions with the reviewers of your grant. You can't just ignore the fact that if you're using a small sample, they're going to question you on the sample size and how generalizable your findings are. So the answer to that kind of challenge is to describe your process very thoroughly. Can somebody understand what you did? Can they compare another study to it? Could they replicate your study? Do you have that degree of description? And you need to address the issue of generalizability just right up front. Oftentimes I will say, you know, our quantitative generalizability just is not the correct criteria to use for qualitative research. But here's what I'm going to tell you about the transferability of my findings. And finally, applicability and action orientation. You need to tell your reviewers exactly how the data can be used. Is it going to change policy? Is it going to improve services? Is it going to lead to a different kind of intervention? How are you going to solve the problems that are identified in the qualitative research?
Okay. We're almost done.
These are just a couple of references that I thought might be helpful for you. The first one is an online resource for guidelines for critically reviewing qualitative studies. And the second one are the COREC criteria It's a checklist for, and it says for interviews and focus groups, but it's really for qualitative research. Those will help you think about, does my proposal or does my manuscript that I've written from my study meet these criteria? So those are really important criteria. Just real quick, some common problems. This is not just with qualitative, but in general with proposal writing. Problems with logic, that you don't have good sequencing or chronology, that your argument's based on a faulty premise, that you need to have clear relevance of your ideas throughout the proposal. How do they relate to each other and to your aims and purpose? Problems with development. What's the rationale, making sure you're integrating, and how many times have I said that, your aims and goals throughout, that you're clear about what it is you're talking about, that you have good detail, you can use visual support, that would be a table or a graph. We use Gantt charts at the end to show timelines so that a reviewer can go through your proposal fairly quickly and get an idea of what you're doing. Is your methodology sound? Do you have good examples? And do you have sound references? Problems with flow. Readability is critical. You have to have good transitions. If the reviewer has to slog through and there's punctuation and grammar problems and wordiness and repetition and it's not clear, they're not, you know, even if it's the best idea in the world, they're not gonna give you a good score. So this is real quick. These are just 10 sort of lessons to tie this all up. A winning proposal is compelling, innovative, clearly written, well-developed, and logical. You need to know who might fund your idea, so you really need to be familiar with what the requirements are of the funding agency and make sure you're linking to that. You need to start early. Now, sometimes you can't. With this PCORI thing we're doing for patient-centered outcomes, the call came out about 3 weeks ago, and it's due December 1st. But if the earlier you can start, the better. Have a planning meeting. Do an outline. Draft your specific aims. Carve out time to write. Shut your door. Clear your desk. Don't look at your email and don't answer your phone. You know, go someplace. You know, go to the beach or whatever, but carve out that time to write. If you keep getting interrupted, you're going to lose your train of thought. It's good sometimes to do a framing exercise. Talk about, and you can do this with somebody, but what do you want to do? What do you want to know? Is it novel and innovative? Or how can I make it novel and innovative? Maybe it's a new approach to an old problem, like the thing that I described about the scientist who looked at, used patient safety as a way to help with nurses' back injuries. What are some of the compelling problems that we're all facing in public health nursing, and how can we make the reviewers believe that they're as compelling as we know they are? Your specific aims have to be specific, realistic, and attainable. Don't be doing, you know, everything in the world, or the reviewer is going to say, this is impossible to do in 2 years with $30,000. You know, that's really critical. Writing is a dynamic process. I've talked a little about this. You got to think about how you write. Some people are more linear. I'm very nonlinear. I might write, you know, my preliminary study section before I write my background and significance and go back and forth. And you're going to be doing ongoing revisions. Readability is key. Reviewers have too many proposals and too little time, so you have to make yours stand out. You remember the movie Jerry Maguire when they said, you had me at hello? You got to have a hook. You got to have them at hello. Use tables and models and charts to help make it easier for them to read. Edit, 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 revise, revise, revise. I can't say this enough. It's really, really important. And those are really the elements of a really good proposal. You have to have, it has to be well written and with a good idea. You have to be qualified to do it. Has to be appropriately ambitious but not too complex. Qualitative research is another way of knowing. It can be an adjunct to quantitative. We can mix it with quantitative methods. I will tell you that I believe that you come with a particular approach just because if you're addressing a question from a qualitative approach, it doesn't mean you can't be collecting quantitative data. We have screening data in our study. We're collecting the PHQ-9, which is a depression screen. We're collecting a screen on preparedness for the caregivers. It's a qualitative study, but it's okay. It's comparative data. We have a saying, all is data. It's the approach that you're taking that makes it either a qualitative study or a quantitative study, not the kind of data that you're collecting. That's really important. And that approach then drives these other things we've talked about. And I thought we'd end with the same person we started with. And we're all geniuses at this conference because our focus is on prevention. So it's, you know, I think as public health nurses, we have an opportunity here to, you know, to focus on prevention. Actually, that was what made our one of the things that made our study novel, is we are focusing on preventing caregiver burden. We're calling what we do a primary prevention strategy. Nobody has ever looked at it that way before. So we talk about after they become burdened, trying to reduce the burden, but preventing it before it happens. So. And happy Halloween. So, does anybody have? I know we went right up to the moment, but if anybody has questions, I'd be happy to stay and entertain them. But thank you for your attention, and I hope this was helpful.